From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Anonymized location data from cell phone apps has revealed that anti-lockdown protesters in states like Michigan may have spread the COVID-19 virus far and wide. The Committee to Protect Medicare found that Trump-supporting anti-lockdown protesters may be spreading the dreaded disease as they congregate with one another in the hundreds and then return to their communities in different regions. Meanwhile, a mathematical model published this week estimates that more than 200,000 lives may have been saved nationwide by stay-at-home orders and that more than 2 million hospitalizations may have been avoided. And the FBI has warned authorities that some white supremacist groups have been encouraging their members to knowingly spread the virus to local police agencies and Jewish organizations. My guest is Dr. Rob Davidson, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Medicare. He's an emergency physician who serves families and small communities across Western Michigan. Welcome to the program, Dr. Davidson.
Thank you, Sonali.
So tell me about this data, where it came from, and what it means to you.
Right, the Committee Protect Medicare worked in conjunction with VoteMap, and the data is basically from folks who have opted into certain programs on their smartphones, and when they access those particular apps, it basically pings their location. It's completely anonymous; only the cell phone carriers know who the individuals are. So none of that data is available. But when these folks, at the time of these protests, and for instance in Lansing, Michigan, the very widely publicized armed protesters who went into the Capitol building on April 30th, they collected this information from, I believe, around 800 and some people at that protest or in that vicinity. And then they mapped it out over the next 48 hours. About every 6 hours, they collected the information of where those particular cell phones ended up, again, whenever these people interacted with the particular apps that pinged their location, finding that the folks who were in this vicinity ended up in West Michigan around Grand Rapids and Northern Michigan, a few of them in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, a few of them over the border into Indiana, all the way to Detroit. And so the concern is, even if a few of these people who were gathered in very tight quarters in the Michigan protests in particular, they were indoors, most of them not wearing masks, screaming and yelling and chanting, that the virus, I mean, that's a prime setup for the virus to spread from one to another. And these people potentially could bring the virus back to their communities, to their grocery stores and pharmacies and their families, worsening this outbreak and actually necessitating a longer stay at home and delaying the opening or the safe opening of the state of Michigan and really the country in general.
So the data that your organization gathered sounds like it basically shows that people were engaging in a group activity indoors while yelling and screaming, all of which are risk factors for spreading the disease if there was even just one infected person there. And then, well, the data would just show that they were together. We know from video and audio footage and documents and journalism what they were doing there. But then it shows that they went and spread out in different parts of the state, possibly even crossed state lines. And if anybody got infected while they were at those protests, it's likely that they would be spreading it, especially if they continued to flout lockdown orders. They would be spreading it in their communities.
Correct. And if they're not wearing masks, again, the reason we wear masks in public is to protect other people from ourselves, particularly if we're symptomatic, but we know a significant number of people can spread the virus without symptoms. So we're basically entering a social compact with our neighbors and our friends and our fellow Americans to protect them from a virus that we potentially harbor. So as these folks continue to go out in their communities, presumably not wearing masks, as they were not wearing masks at this event, they have the very high risk of spreading it onto other people unknowingly.
So the data, of course, can't show whether somebody is infected and whether they're actually spreading the disease. To do that, you need something like authorities call contact tracing, right? Which is something that these protesters are extremely against because it would somehow violate their freedoms to monitor public health.
Correct. Recent polling suggests 51% of people would accept contact tracing if it was administered by a public health entity. We can't be sure if there's any overlap there, but one would argue a significant majority of the folks at these protests would likely not be the folks willing to submit themselves to contact tracing.
It's amazing some of what the signs were saying at these protests, and they took place in Michigan and Pennsylvania, in California, all over in so many different parts of the country. There was one sign in particular held by a man that simply said, "Selfish and proud," which sort of encompasses to me what these protests are about, because some of them at the protests are wearing masks. In Southern California, there were car protests that were held by anti-lockdown activists, which seemed confusing to me. You know, they didn't get out of their cars because they were worried about, because they were trying to observe social distancing, but they were protesting to end the lockdown. There's all these interesting contradictions between what the actions are of these activists. And one thing seems clear, they have said their freedom is more important than our safety. So they're almost acknowledging that this is a dangerous virus and that they don't care.
Yeah, I mean, we have all sorts of rules in our society that are intended to protect others from our potential behaviors. We have speed limit rules. We have lane lines. You know, we have
seatbelt laws.
Yeah, I mean, seatbelts are really to protect the individual. But also, you know, I know the first seatbelt laws were for children because, you know, they don't have a say in who's protecting them or not. And so, you know, really, these just are a set of rules, in some cases from the federal government, just recommendation. But in certain states, rules and public health statements that are intended to protect the population as a whole. And really, if people's ultimate goal is to open up the country, to allow businesses to open safely, these rules are there so we can actually do that more quickly. The more that they flout those rules, the more likely it is that the virus just continues on, continues growing, the more likely we are to have a second wave, even before we're done with the first wave, and the more likely we are to have stops and starts to this economy, really making it unable for us to open it up completely and get back to the business that people would like to do.
You're in Michigan. How do you assess what Governor Gretchen Whitmer has done in order to try to bring the spread of COVID-19 under control?
Well, she has been extremely effective. We have had one of the strictest stay-at-home orders in the country because we actually had one of the worst outbreaks in the country, certainly outside of the New York City metro area, probably the worst outbreak in Southeast Michigan. And so she prevented us from having major spikes in West Michigan, where I work, and in Northern Michigan. And she should be lauded for that. But instead, people use the fact that we didn't have major illness, major spikes, and major overwhelming situations in our hospitals and other parts of the state. Their interpretation of that is, well, this means we didn't need to do anything in the first place. Well, I think that's 180 degrees from reality. She prevented this. And now she is using data, using trend lines of the number of cases, number of hospitalizations, starting to relax measures. And the current stay-at-home order ends, I think, in 10 days from now. And we'll see what happens after that based on the trend over the next 10 days. But we're hoping that safely we can start opening up little by little and eventually get to a lasting state where people can exist in the new normal and function as they would like.
Are you worried about reopening when there really hasn't been enough public education on the importance of social distancing? I mean, you know, I'm in Southern California, and in Los Angeles County, our mayor has mandated masks to be worn in public at all times. That's also been the case in, you know, sort of patchwork recommendations all around the country in individual cities and some states. But people aren't really observing them, not 100% anyway. In fact, I think not even 50% of people are observing them. And if they're not out there wearing masks or distancing themselves, and if they're crowding into bars and restaurants, you can't ease a lockdown properly, right?
Correct. And what we have to recognize is that the safest thing to do would be to stay home. That is the safest thing to do. If you're going to venture out into public, the next thing we need to do is have everyone wearing masks, is everyone observing that 6-foot distancing, and limit their travel as much as possible. So, you know, as I'm actually going to be starting a program in public health in the fall to get my master's in that. But as a public health individual now, and you know, with whatever platform I have, what I'm trying to do is to get the most information out to the most people. And so, you know, as many people as we have wearing masks, if we could increase that by, you know, 10%, 15%, that's going to help. As many people as are, you know, going out or staying home, the more people we convince that staying home is probably the better idea, or that 6 foot distancing is better. It's just going to increase our chances to have a smaller outbreak, to not overwhelm our hospitals. And that's really what public health is, just like the data we see from cell phones. We can't directly draw conclusions that they're spreading the virus, but we know when there are situations that increase the risk, that just increases the potential number of cases. So everything we can do to decrease risk is going to make us better off in the end.
There just is so much misinformation among the Trump-supporting public, who are, of course, where the anti-lockdown protests are drawn from. Misinformation that runs the gamut from wearing masks makes you sicker or activates the virus, as one conspiracy theorist says in a new, very popular online video that I don't want to name, to all the way to this idea that the big pharmaceutical companies have created this myth in order to sell vaccinations, and that vaccines are going to be more harmful than the actual virus, or even that the virus itself is an entire hoax. We had the son of our president, Eric Trump, say as much in an interview recently, that the virus is just going to disappear in November because it is all apparently some part of an elaborate hoax to get Trump, to lose the election. As a physician, how deeply difficult is your job in the face of these baseless and sadly far too widespread theories, I should say?
I mean, it's incredibly difficult. Throughout my career, I've had challenges with patients whose parents have not gotten them routine vaccinations, which I know are life-saving. But really, in this case, we have a very small subset of individuals who are fomenting these conspiracy theories, who are spreading them. The problem is from the very top, from President Trump, Vice President Pence, now President Trump's son is weighing in, from folks throughout the administration, continuing, you know, starting in February, where President Trump called it a hoax, to his continued resistance to wearing masks when he's in public. I know he's coming to Michigan in 3 days. We're going to urge that he wears masks when he goes to a plant that's making ventilators and masks for those of us in the medical community. If he wants to model good behavior, he should wear a mask. Vice President Pence didn't wear a mask at Mayo, even though it's within their rules that you need to wear masks. And so really, it starts at the top. And them modeling poor behavior is allowing these conspiracy theories to take hold and to spread, and for people to, you know, people who otherwise wouldn't participate in them, to look at what the president's doing and say, well, you know, it must be true that masks aren't needed because the president refuses to wear them.
It's quite remarkable. The president's own wife, the first lady, has promoted the use of mask wearing in April. She posted a photo of herself with a mask and cited CDC guidelines. And the wearing of face masks seems to be this new fault line in American politics between Trump supporters and the rest of us. It's so strange, given that everybody at the White House, you know, because several people in the top echelons of government tested positive, everybody at the White House, except for Trump, are wearing masks, I suppose, to protect him. But he won't wear one because he doesn't, of course, care about protecting others. They've also talked about how testing is not an important tool. But of course, the White House tests everybody every day who enter or leave the White House. Now we have found out, by the way, that those tests have been deeply inaccurate. But it's really interesting to see the White House send these mixed messages. That's what's good for the White House is not good for the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really an amazing mixed message to say that, A, testing is overrated, and then, B, we're going to test at the White House daily, but there's not enough tests for the rest of you. And really, you know, of all of the failures of the administration on their on healthcare in general, but on their response to this pandemic, the continued failure of a lack of widespread testing, the lack of a coordinated effort for testing and tracing, the lack of a supply chain that is reliable for the states for the supplies needed to test, is the ongoing failure. We could talk about it every day, 24 hours a day, because it just hasn't been fixed. And we have a president and an administration who is simply not willing to admit it's a problem, and in fact, do the opposite and claim victory when it comes to testing.
depending upon who your health insurer is, which state you live in, you may have one kind of a test or may have easier access than someone else. Or of course, if you've lost your job, you may not have health insurance altogether. And I want to ask you, Rob, you're the executive director of the Committee to Protect Medicare. Had we had a national health plan in place in the United States before such a pandemic hit, a federally run national health program like the kind you have in the UK or in Canada, wouldn't we have been better poised to tackle this problem in a much more organized fashion?
100%. We don't even have to conjecture that that might be true. We can look at other countries where that is the case. And if you look at a country like Germany, like France, like the UK, like Canada, zero people have lost their health insurance through the economic downturn. So, I mean, we have really a double whammy. We have a public health crisis where people are going to need to and have needed to and will continue to need to avail themselves of healthcare and of the services of hospitals. At the same time, we have people in a country like the United States where many people have their insurance tied to employment, losing their jobs.
And by the way, the anti-lockdown folks are, or I should say the anti-Medicare folks are pointing to Italy as an example of how such a national health program doesn't work because Italy had so many fatalities related to COVID and they also have a national health program. What's your response to that?
I think when you have a pandemic of a virus that's this deadly, that's this easily spread, and it gets into the populations that are most at risk, the health system you have isn't going to stop some of those people, particularly early on, from having massive fatalities. And that is happening in this country because of the lack of a response by this president, by this government. I think the ongoing risk in a country like ours is once we flatten that curve and we start to open up again and we know more about the virus, we still have a system that's unable to deal with so many people who don't have insurance. We're not going to see the full effects of that probably for months. And looking back over the next few years, how those people losing their insurance impacted the mortality. We know a study out of Stanford at the end of last year showed us that people without insurance have a 0.2% higher mortality over even a very short period of time. And so with something like this, if that's the case with millions of people potentially infected, tens of millions or hundreds of millions, that those are real lives that will be lost that we just won't know about until we look back and do the analysis.
There is, of course, economic collapse as a result of the ongoing lockdown. But one sector that has been hit really hard is the private for-profit healthcare system, which is sort of ironic, but it points to the glaring flaws in our system, doesn't it? We have hospitals losing billions of dollars a day. These are mostly private hospitals, of course, because people have canceled all of those expensive procedures that they tend to make their money from, surgeries and other elective procedures and diagnostic tools. And ironically, coming out of this pandemic, we may see a dearth of hospitals serving the most vulnerable communities because they were forced to shutter since their for-profit model failed during a pandemic.
Well, I would argue that the hospital systems are absolutely suffering, as well as, you know, doctors and nurses, you know, everyone's revenues are down. But the really egregious side of this is that the for-profit insurance industry is actually going to, they're anticipating the same amount of profit as they did before the pandemic hit. They think 2020 is going to be a banner year because they've been collecting premiums all along and they have not had to put the money out for some of these semi-elective or elective procedures that they normally would have to cover. The other piece, and I'm very frustrated by the Democrats in the House, is that their version that they put forth in this most recent stimulus is a COBRA premium subsidy program so that people who lost their insurance when they lost their jobs can continue with their private for-profit insurance and the government will pay the premiums. I much more support a measure put forth by Congresswoman Jayapal and Congressman Kennedy that essentially expands Medicaid and Medicare to cover those folks who have lost their jobs, a much cheaper way to do it, and we're not propping up the for-profit health insurance industry. That, to me, is the absolutely egregious part of all of this.
It's interesting that everyone's for the free market, except when they're busy pouring tax dollars into propping up the free market. as it fails. So finally, I'm also wondering whether you think that the current state that this country is in with, you know, the leading the world with infections and deaths is going to get worse before it gets better. I mean, there's no federal leadership. The CDC has been completely undermined. States have a patchwork response. The anti-lockdown protesters are going around, you know, potentially spreading this virus because they have admitted they don't care about the rest of us. People of color are more vulnerable to the disease because of pre-existing conditions. It doesn't seem to me that we have anything in this nation's future that indicates we're going to get out of this with minimal fatalities. If anything, the maximum number of fatalities possible is what we might see in our future. And that is terrifying. We could have possibly, what, hundreds of thousands, maybe even more than a million people dead before the end of it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're going to hit 100,000 people dead in the next few weeks, certainly by the end of this month. And I think it's inconceivable that we don't hit 200,000 by Election Day. I think my only hope is that some of our most populous states with our most populous regions within the states do have governors who have shown the ability to respond quickly and to resist their own legislatures, such as here in Michigan. Governor Whitmer is being sued by the Michigan legislature. Governor Evers in Wisconsin was successfully sued. Now, hopefully that goes to a higher court and perhaps they can reinstate his ability to respond.
But not Governor before Cuomo, lots of people probably got infected in Wisconsin.
For sure. But I do have hope that our governors, as I mean, they are the only reason that we were able to flatten the curve. It had no bearing on what President Trump did. He basically told the governors, it's up to you. And frankly, many of them responded. So that is my only hope that we can limit this to any extent possible. But I share your concern that the lack of federal leadership, at least until January of 2021, is going to make it difficult. And whatever the number ends up being, we know that it's going to be significantly higher than it ever had to be because President Trump has failed us.
And I just do have one last question for you. Given what some other countries have successfully been able to institute in halting the spread of the disease, do you recommend, as a cheap and not so difficult to bear restriction, that all Americans really ought to be wearing face masks every time they're out of doors? This is not a very difficult thing to do. It does not impact your health. You can tie a bandana around your face. I don't see enough messaging from the government, state or federal, to wear masks. I mean, there ought to be billboards everywhere encouraging people to do so and explaining the science. There's some scientists that are suggesting that if 80% of the population were to wear face masks, we would stop the spread of this disease.
Yeah, I think I've seen that same data, and I would agree. Now, if people live in rural areas and they go out for a run, they go out for a walk, and they should bring a mask always. I always do. I live in a rural area. I go for runs. I bring a mask. But I go on a run where I don't see a single soul the entire run. Or if I do, I run on the other side of the street, 20-some feet away from that individual. And so I can effectively socially distance by, you know, several fold of what the recommendations are. If you're going to any public space that is enclosed, 100%, you should wear a mask. I do. I turn around and leave the place if there's people in there without masks on. And if you're going out in public, you should always bring a mask with you. A cloth mask that you can put on, and then when you get home, you wash it, you wash your hands when you take it off. That absolutely should be the standard. It is the standard in many states. That's what our governor here is recommending. The more we message on this, you are right, the more people we can get to do this. Not everybody. It's impossible to get everybody on board. But the more we do, the less people will get infected, the less people will die.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today. What's a website where people can find out more about the work you do?
It's committeetoprotect.org.
We'll post a link to that from our website. Thank you so much, Rob, for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. Have a great day.
My guest has been Dr. Rob Davidson, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Medicare. He's an emergency physician who serves families and small communities across Western Michigan. We've been discussing anti-lockdown protesters and the continuing spread of COVID-19. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.